Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Sign up at decodingtv.com and get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and bonus episodes we'll record just for you. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com that makes this show possible.
What's an Imperial Lieutenant doing getting involved with this?
What difference does it make?
Everyone else seems to know.
He fell in love with a local woman, lost a promotion. Then he lost the woman. Then he lost his taste for the Empire. Everyone has their own rebellion.
Our Own Rebellion, hosting a weekly podcast about the Disney Plus original series Andor. Hello, everyone. I'm David Chen.
And I'm Patrick Willems.
Welcome to Decoding TV. On this week's episode of Decoding TV, we're going to be covering Season 1, Episode 5 of Andor, streaming right now on Disney Plus, entitled The Axe Forgets. This episode was directed by Susanna White, written by Dan Gilroy. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Find us also on YouTube, TikTok, and Twitter at Decoding TV. We will, during the course of this Decoding TV episode, spoil everything about Season 1, Episode 5. We won't spoil anything from future weeks. That includes anything on next time on previews or anything else of that nature. But before we get into this week's episode, Patrick.
Yes, David.
Let's talk about some of the feedback and responses we received to last week's episode of our Andor discussion.
I'm assuming that everyone loved it and thought it was an amazing episode and that we are the best podcasters around.
I mean, not only the best, the only Andor / Star Wars podcast that exists currently, you know,
as far as I'm aware.
On occasion, we do make mistakes on this podcast / YouTube show, and we are sorry about it. But, you know, sometimes we make mistakes, sometimes we don't elaborate as much as we should. Here are some elaborations / clarifications / corrections from last week. First of all, I got a bunch of messages from folks saying, hey, David Chen, don't feel too bad. It was actually pronounced Coruscant until episode 1 when George Lucas changed it for Phantom Menace. So I don't know if you're aware of that, Patrick, but it was Coruscant in like pre, you know, 1990s or so time period.
As in before anyone ever said it out loud.
I think so, there might have been some audiobooks or something like that that, you know, that may have used it, but yes.
Well, David, if you get a time machine and travel back 24 years, you will be totally correct.
Wow. Okay. Biting. Okay. Anyway, thank you for that, Patrick. But anyway, thanks for all the kind notes from people saying I wasn't completely always wrong for all of time to say Coruscant that way. We got a comment on YouTube from, and I apologize if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly, the Makole Mbembe on YouTube, who typically chimes in every week with some really great kind of lore corrections and information for us. So, this person writes, if I recall correctly, and this is referring to Mon Mothma's career in the Senate, okay?
A thing so, I was like frantically trying to research during the episode.
Yes, yes. The Mkole Mbembe writes, if I recall correctly, Mon Mothma quits the Senate and officially joins the Rebel Alliance in Rebels. Though given that that show and this one will probably overlap in time, we may see it later in Andor as well. The event that makes her decide to do this is called the Gorman Massacre. Like so much of the lore in this era and show, that event, or at least its basic concept, goes all the way back to the old tabletop role-playing game. In that version of the story, and I guess I should point out before I proceed reading that you might consider this a spoiler if you don't want to know, because this might happen later in Andor, so heads up. But in that version of the story, the people of the planet Gorman took over and occupied Imperial landing zones to stage protests against the government. In response, Governor Tarkin landed his ship on the protesters, killing a ton of people. What's interesting about this in the context of Andor is that Mon Mothma specifically mentions Gorman and how it's being f***ed over by the Empire in the argument with her husbands. Shades of things to come, perhaps, end quote. So
David, I thought there was no profanity on this podcast.
It's I shouldn't have. I'm going to go bleep that out, Patrick. All right. Good call. But anyway, so yeah, it's interesting that Mon Mothma might be affected by this event that may take place in the future of Andor. And I'm really curious if Andor is going to depict it differently than it's been depicted in the past, you know, because, yeah.
Yeah. David, have you watched Rebels?
I have not.
Neither have I. Yeah. I have, in terms of the Star Wars animated stuff, which is, there's so much of it now that that's where a lot of, like, a lot of lore comes from the animated shows. I have watched, I think, maybe 3 or 4 seasons of The Clone Wars. At some point, I will get back to it and watch, like, the second half of the show. And I haven't watched any of Rebels. I think I will at some point, but, you know, there's a lot of television. And mm-hmm. so those are always, like, kind of blind spots for me when it comes to like, okay, this time period, stuff that, you know, was added to canon from the animated shows. I'm always, like, trying to catch up and fill in those blanks because I'm not an expert.
Got a bunch of comments on YouTube, and also somebody named Holton DM'd me on Instagram and said, quote, "You talked about Andor saying he was in prison when what he was talking about was Mimban, the same mud planet from Solo. When he was talking about fighting themselves, he was talking about how soon after the Republic helped the Mimbanese free their planet, the Republic became the Empire and tried to take over, hence fighting their previous allies," end quote. So just wanted to clarify, last week, Andor mentioned he was a Mimban fighting. We saw fighting on Mimban in Solo, A Star Wars Story, some actually really effective sequences in that movie.
That's where Han Solo met Chewie.
Indeed.
Yeah. So. And I will say I had no idea what that planet was called until right now.
All right. Well, there you go. So I think we had trouble hearing and making out some of the names in last week's episode, but that shouldn't be a problem for future weeks. I'm just going to put that out there. So
yes.
Okay. So thank you all for your corrections. Keep them coming in to decodingtv@gmail.com or, you know, Twitter. We're online all the time. So we appreciate accuracy and precision, and we don't want to make any mistakes when it comes to Star Wars lore. But we will occasionally make mistakes, and we appreciate your patience with us in that. So,
David, you know one of the things I like about this show?
What is it, Patrick?
It's that on this show, I am technically the Star Wars expert, despite not being a real Star Wars expert. That's a thing that, like, people are really experts in, and I'm not that. And so mm-hmm. sometimes I get to feel like the expert, and then there are times like this where I'm like, I don't know anything about that at all. Mm-hmm.
That's your favorite thing about the show, Patrick.
I think I said one of my favorite things about the show. My favorite thing about the show is the opportunity to have structured time to hang out with you every week for a couple months, and then it ends.
All right. Well, Patrick H. Willems, let's dive into season 1, episode 5 of Andor. The Axe Forgets is the name of the episode. Let's start by talking about overall thoughts on the episode. What do you think of this episode overall?
I really liked this episode while being aware that it's all I can. Okay. When we were talking last week, we were like, well, we assume that next episode we're going to have the heist and we're going to have Mon Mothma's dinner party. And we didn't get either of those things. and yet I didn't really mind, because as I was watching this episode and as it was going on, and when we're about halfway through, I'm realizing, yeah, the heist isn't going to happen. It's not going to be like a 10-minute sequence. And I really kind of realized, like, of course, if these are 3-episode arcs, the heist is like the climactic episode. And this is all build up to the heist, all character developments to make us more invested in everything going into it. And this all felt pretty vital to me. And in so much of it, I kept, like, the work that this show is doing to really reframe how we think of the rebellion in Star Wars and put, like, actual human faces on it and really, like, understand, like, the ideology behind the people who signed up for this. It's really working for me. I'm I'm very invested in every storyline that's happening with all, it's been said time and time again. It was said about Rogue One, and I think it kind of applies there, but I think it really applies here, of just how genuinely exciting it is to see a thing we're very familiar with from a very new perspective with a totally different vibe. And I really like everything the show is doing. And I gotta say, I was a big fan of this episode, despite no dinner party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the biggest downside for you. I like this episode a lot as well. Here's my experience watching it is I'm like 20 to 30 minutes into it. I'm like, oh no, like there's not enough time to do a full heist at the end of it. Like as I'm watching it, I'm like waiting for the heist. And it's like, there's not going to be enough time at the end of the this episode for the heist. So we did not get the heist this episode, unfortunately. All the stuff that took place on Aldani is basically designed to develop these characters more. We're introduced to them rapid fire last episode. Like, here's Steen, Tamarin, you know, Cinta, like all these people. And it's like, okay, am I even going to get to know these people? And the answer to that question is yes in this episode, right? You get to really learn a lot about several of these characters in the episode. And that's great. Love the character development. And having watched it, I'm like, oh, I'm really glad that we got to get to know about these characters before we got into the heist. Now it means a lot more, you know, that we know all this information about these characters. By the way, one other thing I want to point out about the Aldani heist crew is something I've really gotten to appreciate as I've gotten on in years is casting people that look different to be different people in the show. And what I mean by that is, like, every one of the characters in the heist crew has a pretty distinctly different look.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, they're all these different shapes and sizes and genders and colors, basically.
And there's really no mixing up anybody.
Yeah, it really helps you to distinguish who is who. And that's, like, not something people might think about when you're casting. Is like, we need to make everyone look extremely different so they're distinguishable. But another show that recently did it recently, that did it the same thing recently, although not to the same degree, is there's a Netflix television series called All of Us Are Dead. I don't know if you saw this. It's a Korean zombie horror.
I heard about it.
It's awesome. You should. People listening should totally watch it. But
David, I just remembered. I heard about it because of you talking about
yes. it. Yes. It's a Korean zombie horror show that's on Netflix. It's amazing. Would highly recommend. But basically, you're following this crew of students as they try to survive a zombie apocalypse. And every one of the students has, like, a distinctly different look. Like, one has glasses and one's wearing a skirt and one's wearing a sweater or, like, whatever. And it's just basically, like, it's so helpful to, like, help you, like, just visually demarcate who is who. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure the youngins in the audience are like, I don't have any need of that. I can memorize everything. I'm like, I'm getting old. Okay. I need as much help as I can get when it comes to understanding my TV
right.
shows.
So. I mean, honestly, this is going to be a really obvious one, but it kind of reminds me of The Bear on Hulu, mm-hmm. Partly because they share a cast member, Eben Moss Bacharach, who plays Skeen
who basically
here.
Is playing the same character in this movie, in this show, I should say.
Exactly. I mean, I kept just waiting for him to, like call Nemec cousin at some point, like, just because.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like same kind of thing on that show, which is like a bunch of people packed together in like close quarters. It really helps even before you like learn everyone's names, just being like, oh, right. Everyone is a very distinct type. Everyone like looks different. It like has a distinct personality. Like it's like TV is full of shows that are just full of like vaguely similar looking white people. And so it's helpful, especially because after episode 6, we might not see these characters anymore. It's mm-hmm. totally possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say all the non-heist stuff in this episode was only okay. You know, like, there's some nice moments in it, but it feels like we're just kind of checking in with all these characters before some of their storylines really take off. The focus of season 1, episode 5 was really the heist. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good heist setup episode, I would say. I thought we were getting the heist setup last episode. That was just a taste of the heist setup. This is the real heist setup, right?
I mean, when you get to the... I apologize to, like, vaguely skip ahead, but, like, you know, when we see them burning the models of like that they used to plan the heist, that's when I'm like, oh man, this is serious. This is like there's no going back. Like just the visual of like of burning down the miniature version of the place that they are going to rob.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, yeah, like there's all the, like, also we saw a bunch of stuff with Lieutenant Gorn at the garrison in this episode. And that, and just like seeing like how things are run there. We actually saw in this episode the payroll that they are going to steal inside a vault.
Yes.
And it really, like, this was, as much as this was almost all just like people having conversations, like not even always, although okay, I will say there was Skeen putting a knife to Cassian's throat. There was, the people did have hands on blasters, but like it was a pretty conflict light episode. Mostly people talking, but like I am so anxious about what's going to happen in the next episode now because of everything that happened here.
The wait until next episode is going to be a challenging one for sure. So
it is. And well, I will say, do we want to get into the stuff off of Aldani?
Yeah, let's
story lines.
We're going to start by talking about all the plot lines that are not Aldani, and then we'll get to Aldani. All right. So let's
start with David's favorite character. The character that David thinks is really misunderstood and that we should all really like be supporting and feeling for because he's going through a rough time.
Hashtag Team Karn. We start on Coruscant with Cyril Karn. He's at home. His mom is treating him like a kid. He's eating Cheerio or the
space
Star
cereal.
Wars space cereal. Looks like Crunch Berries, to be honest with you.
It
Captain
does.
Crunch, kind of.
Yeah,
with the blue milk. You know,
oops, so. All space berries. Wait, David, by the way, a thing, I don't think we mentioned this in the previous episode, that Catherine Hunter, who plays Edie Karn, Karn's mom, is the witches from Joel Cohen's Macbeth.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
First of all, the witches, that the way the witches are conceived in that version of Macbeth is incredible. Right, like it's just one of the highlights of the movie. Too, you should watch that version of the Tragedy of Macbeth just to see the witches, and that's the same actor, right?
Yeah, and it was a thing where obviously it seems like she's had a long illustrious career in like the London theater scene. She's probably been in like movies or TV before. I've probably seen her somewhere. I did not know her name until The Tragedy of Macbeth, where she kind of steals the movie playing all three witches. I did not realize until I was like, we were putting together our list of the cast in our like, you know, our show notes and everything. And I was like looking her up on IMDb and I was like, oh wait, that's how I know that name, Catherine Hunter. So this show has a very good cast.
I mean, she has so much range. So the actress's name is what again? Catherine Hunter, right?
Yes.
And she was in the Tragedy of Macbeth and Andor. In one of those things, she intones ominous predictions about the future to a tortured soul. And the other one is the Tragedy of Macbeth.
I was about to say, that was a Boom Goes the Dynamite, right?
Thank you.
That was a classic Dave Chen.
Yes. Love it. Okay. Anyway, yes. She is not too happy about where Karn has landed. He never was supposed to go into police work anyway, and they're going to get their uncle Harlow to maybe help give him a job. So that's basically what the Karn storyline amounts to this episode. And then Karn in his childhood bedroom looking at this hologram of Andor just hating on him.
He also, out of focus in the background in his bedroom, he has what look like action figures. I love the Karn storyline. We only see a little bit of it in this episode, but just, I mean, he is experiencing like the classic thing of, oh, you lose your job and then have to move back in with your parents and then hope that maybe your uncle can like
hook you
can
up
can help
yeah.
you get a new job and you have to like start a new career. It is, I mean, he might as well just be like, I don't know, any millennial who gets like laid off.
Any millennial who happens to have done something at their job that led to the death of five people, you know?
Look, we've all been there.
So, anyway, what else happened?
Yeah, go ahead. I will say, as my, I'm going to pop up on like every episode just being like, let me talk about how much I love the production design and stuff like that. Also, a thing that I've just been learning as I've been like reading like every interview with like Tony Gilroy and stuff like this. His episode of WTF with Marc Maron just came out like a day or two ago. And that's
nice.
There isn't a lot of talk. Yeah, not a lot of talk about Andor, but it's a really good episode. And just like his life is very interesting.
Yes.
But apparently, like, he was very set on hiring a lot of crew people who were not, like, Star Wars veterans.
Mm.
Like, it's interesting. The, like, I believe all the other Star Wars shows, their production designer is Doug Chang, who is, like, a decades-long, like, storied Lucasfilm guy. He's been designing Star Wars stuff, like, I think since, like, maybe since at least the prequel era. And then for this show, Gilroy was like, no, I don't want any of the regular people. I want to get the production designer. And I think they also had the producer from Chernobyl. And so, yeah, new production designer who has not worked on Star Wars before. And I like the look of the Karn family's apartment where they have like they eat breakfast at like this booth inside. Like it's almost like a diner booth, like inside the apartment. It looks so cool. And I know I talked about like the costume design last week, but I was very struck by just like the interior of the apartment. It looks great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no disagreement. All right, what else happens this episode that's not the Aldani storyline? We get some Coruscant scenes with Mon Mothma.
There's an important thing that that happened for Star Wars canon here.
And what is that?
So we learned that Mon Mothma has a daughter.
Yes.
Who shows up in this episode.
Named
we have
Leeda, I believe.
Leeda.
Right?
And this is, you know, as much as I was bummed out, we first see her, it seems like, at breakfast to the morning after the dinner party that I wanted to see so bad. And her daughter comes in, and her daughter, who's like a teenager, and it's – obviously, things were a little frosty between Mon Mothma and Perrin, her husband, in the last episode. And now it really seems like Perrin has kind of got their daughter Leeda, like, on his side. And, like, Mon Mothma, the interesting thing is, like, you know, she's going to be this big legendary rebel leader and yet, like, can't even, like, lead her family. Like, her daughter and husband seem to be like, against her and do not like her very much. But the canonical thing is that so Leeda apparently, I'm checking the notes that I wrote down. So Leeda was actually so David, just are you familiar with the difference between Star Wars Legends and canon?
No, please illustrate or illuminate, okay. I should say.
So for many years, for decades, there was what is known as the Star Wars Expanded Universe, yes. Which were all of the books or like novels and comic books and video games that were outside of just the core movies that George Lucas wrote and or directed. And there were many, many storylines. They went on like way past the end of Return of the Jedi. They built out the like and as everyone
I actually read a bunch of these books when I was a kid. Like Timothy Zahn's books basically, right?
Exactly.
Admiral Thrawn, like all that stuff. Yeah. So that's Star Wars Legends.
That is Legends. And the thing is, this was all canonical in Star Wars lore for a very long time. And despite the fact that anyone who knows anything about the expanded universe is aware that some of it was stupid. Like Chewie eventually dies because a moon falls on him. There was like some sort of like evil Luke twin named Luke with two U's, stuff like that. Anyway, when Disney acquired Lucasfilm and started production on the sequel trilogy, they announced that all the expanded universe was being struck from canon, and was now considered legends, as in those are Star Wars stories, but they are not part of the core canon that is being continued by all this new material, which does make sense because since there were already many, many, many books about what happens after Return of the Jedi, that they weren't just going to adapt into the sequel trilogy, it would conflict. And
well, clearly they had an intricate plan for episodes 7 through 9. So like, you would never want to interfere with that intricate plan, right?
Of course, of course. God forbid. hashtag where is Luke with 2 U's? So anyway, the thing is, Leeda, Mon Mothma's daughter, was actually – it was first mentioned in, I believe, 1993 that she had a daughter. And then her daughter was named – was given the name Leeda in 2002. And also, Leeda had a brother, apparently. And then what happened – but this is the first time. But obviously, that stuff was stricken from canon. It is legends. Does not count. This, to my knowledge – until someone in the comments section points out that I'm wrong, is the first mention of Leeda in the new canon of Star Wars. But there's no brother here. And so this is one of these examples, kind of like Grand Admiral Thrawn, where they are things that were originally introduced in Legends, in stuff that is no longer canon, where the people making the new Star Wars stories decide, you know what? That was a good idea. Let's pluck that and now make it canon. With, you know, some adjustments such as no brother this time. But so this is big. Mon Mothma's daughter appearing for the first time. Unless I'm wrong.
For
the first time in the new canon. Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, most of the stuff that we get there with the moth. Can I point out something that I think is funny?
Yes.
I have never heard anyone refer to Mon Mothma by her first name and not her full her full name. Calling her just Mon just sounds funny. Like, hey, what's up, Mon? Do people say? I hope someone says that to her. during the season.
I never assumed that Mon was the name. I assumed that Mon might have been like a prefix or a, you know. Like in Game of Thrones, they call people like Sir Loras or Sir Jorah, right? And like Sir is like S-E-R is like, so maybe it's like Mon Mothma. But anyway, I think you're probably right that Mon Mothma is her actual name.
I mean, Leeda Mothma
is
apparently her name. And so
I guess it is Mon, yeah.
Yeah, which just sounds funny because if anyone says, like, hello, Mon, it sounds like they're doing, like, a cartoonish Jamaican accent.
So we should stay away from that. But, okay, yeah. back to the scene. There's a couple things I want to point out about it, okay? One is that there's an interesting moment when Perrin says, hey, the driver's here, and she says, you know his name. His name is Chloris. And I thought, huh, what an interesting moment because, first of all, last episode she was just saying that they're replacing all her people. Including the driver, it sounded like. So it was. It felt like she was trying to give this guy some more humanity. But I'm like, didn't you just maybe say he was a spy last episode? That was a little confusing. But I think the arc of what we see in this episode is that Mon Mothma is thinking about the little guy. Basically, you know, she's like, I have this charity. You didn't even know about it. You know, like she's thinking about the little guy, and her husband is really disconnected from that. As you point out, she has a weird relationship with her family. She's supposed to like drive her daughter to this thing, and her daughter's like, don't worry about it. You don't need to do this just to make appearances. Like, it doesn't make sense. And like, it's clear that her husband and her daughter are kind of, aligned.
I mean, I think we see when Mon Mothma and her daughter are arguing, we can see Perrin kind of like smirking there, kind of like amused and like happy that like his daughter is clearly on his side in the matter.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, You point this out, and this is something I've had experience with in the corporate world, right? I have dealt with many, I have been in the presence of many high-powered executives during my time in the corporate world. And what's always fascinating to me is the dynamic where you have these people who have been at this company for years, decades even, and they have a long and storied career, and they've launched products that everyone has used, you know, people you know have used, and then they have a home life where they have a baby or a kid and they can't get their baby or kid to, like, you know, eat their vegetables.
Right.
And it's just like, it's just this kind of duality that work forces upon you. Is at work, you command armies of people to do, sometimes literally armies in the case of the show, And at home, it does none of that matters. None of that matters. Mm-hmm. All that matters is what your dynamic and your relationship is between these people. And I do like that that's illustrated. Like, oh, Mon Mothma, she commanded rebel armies in the future, but also her daughter doesn't respect her. And it's like, you know, that's like it's a very somewhat conventional plot in movies and TV shows. But I do think it's interesting to see a character who has basically just been a figurehead legend in the past of Star Wars. Now we're getting so much more detail about her life. So,
yes.
There is a scene where she's in the car with Cloris, and they're talking about she's in the car with Perrin and Cloris, and they're talking about this foundation that she wanted to make, and it's a charity. And Cloris says, "Hey, I'm sorry." Perrin says, "Hey, Cloris, would you mind taking the expressway?" And I was like, "Oh,
we also we have like a payoff to that earlier moment about the driver's name, where he asks." Mon, yes. What the driver's name is, so that he's making a bit of an effort there.
Yes.
He's like,
oh, totally.
Yeah, he's like, this guy is not a total jerk.
I like the idea that they're like, he says, let's take the expressway. I'm like, wow, the concept of an expressway is so ingrained into humanoid thinking and societies that even a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, they had traffic and expressways that they had to deal with. I looked this up. There have apparently been other expressways in the past in Star Wars. There was this thing called the Lower Ring Expressway, which is a thoroughfare in Bespin's Cloud City that is on Wikipedia or on starwars.fandom.com. So anyway, there have been other... there's also the Tokyo Expressway Battle, I think.
Tokyo?
In Star Wars, well, okay, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. Okay.
Or is it Tokyo spelled like T-O-K-I-O?
I don't, you know, just ignore what I just said about that thing. Point being, this is not the first time the concept of the expressway has ever been floated in Star Wars canon. But I do think it's kind of funny that even in Star Wars, they have expressways. So,
I mean, it's the funny thing with Star Wars, where there's always the question of, like, how much regular, like, our world terminology do they have, and then when do they make up new stuff? Where it's like, I thought about it in this episode, when they still have like left-handed and right-handed,
when
they're talking about that, and
and it's like, oh, they have that concept in Star Wars. I think that's the first time that's been referred to in Star Wars universe, right? So,
well, again, we say that, but there's so many books and cartoons and stuff like that
where they've probably referenced that.
I'm not going to definitively say that. I'll say it's the first time we've encountered that in Star Wars.
We on this podcast have encountered that. And that's it's just interesting. It's not a criticism. It's not a nitpick. It's just like, oh, it's interesting to observe like how many elements they borrow from our real world. So the other thing that happens in this episode, there's a couple of things dealing with Imperial security. So there's a scene on Ferrix. Hey, we're back at Ferrix. Patrick, you predicted correctly. They didn't build that whole set just for the first three episodes.
Yes, but still no sign of Bix.
Yeah, no Bix. What's her name?
Fiona Shaw.
Fiona Shaw, yeah. No Fiona Shaw's character. So who is Cassian's mom, basically adopted mom, right? So
yeah, slash kind of kidnapper.
Yes, correct. Marva is the character's name.
That's
so
it.
But basically what's happening on Ferrix is Blevins is there overseeing the cleanup.
Oh, also one thing that I only confirmed this morning, apparently it's only Blevin, there's no S on the end.
Oh.
I think we both thought last episode that there was Blevins, but maybe they said it but meant like Blevin apostrophe S.
It's Blevins in Wikipedia.
Is it?
Yeah. Although,
but it's Blevin on IMDb.
Yeah. It's actually you're right. It's Blevin on Wikipedia. There's actually a separate Blevins entry in Wikipedia.
So there's
Blevins, a male captain of the Galactic Empire who fought and died on the moon of Endor. And then
that's the one I thought he was.
Yeah, that's who you thought it was. But then there's Blevin, separate entry. So maybe Wikipedia is forking the Blevin thing and, you know, assuming that they're two separate people.
interesting. And mm-hmm. and because I would think
I could have sworn I heard them say Blevins in the actual show though. But anyway.
Yeah, because. David, you're familiar with the Lucasfilm Story Group, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The group of people who basically like work with all the Star Wars productions just to make sure everything like fits into canon and like the timeline is right and that kind of stuff. I would assume that they wouldn't that like if let's say Tony Gilroy just wrote, I don't know, the character's name is Blevin. that they would not. They would
That somebody would say, hey, there's another character named Blevins. Let's like change the name so that it's not the same. Right.
Right. That seems like the kind of thing that they would not miss.
Yeah.
And so especially if the Blevins character who dies in the Battle of Andor was only created in the Aftermath novels like a few years back. And so I'm going to say my guess here is that Wikipedia has messed up and it is the same guy because he already is an Imperial officer.
No, but I think you're right that the character's name is Blevin in the show, though.
Yeah.
I think I misheard it and it's actually Blevin in the show. So anyway.
No. I did it too.
We
were on the same page.
Yeah. We both thought it was Blevin's. Anyway, it was a real Mandela effect there. Okay, Blevin is on Ferrix. He's supervising the cleanup effort. He meets this guy named Captain Tygo. Tygo's kind of the guy who's going to take over. Tygo's going to be the new Karn, except he's going to live amongst the people. He's like, here's your quarters. What do you think of it? And he's like, this is fine, but can I be a prefect? And prefect is kind of like a term of, I guess, prestige. You know, you're kind of running the town, I guess. Later on in the episode, we learn that prefects have done lots of terrible things that have caused people to be radicalized and join the rebellion. But for now, Tygo wants to be a prefect. And I like this idea of, hey, it's these kind of career hungry ladder climbers that are all like, it's all ladder climbers throughout this entire organization. And obviously when that meets supervising a group of people that don't like you, that can often have terrible results that we might see again on Ferrix. You know, it's already been bad, but yeah.
Yeah. The thing that I thought was interesting about this scene is that in one of our past episodes, we talked about the idea of like what planets are like occupied territories here. And I think we were saying that that Ferrix before or the planets that that the pre-ox organization, security organization, like kind of like presided over, weren't quite occupied territories, like compared to like Jeddah in Rogue One.
Right.
But looking at this scene on Ferrix here, I was like, oh, now it is an occupied territory.
Right.
Now, like literally they're looking at a hotel and Blevin is like, yeah, so how about you take over this hotel? How about this is your new headquarters? They're just they're basically just like a like colonizing army coming in here being like, well, okay, let's we live here now and run stuff and we can just use the existing buildings to serve our purposes.
Yeah.
And it seems like in the background, it looks like, are they like scrubbing graffiti off of buildings?
Hmm. Yeah, I didn't pay that close attention to what was happening in the background, but yeah, it's. I agree with your assessment of what is currently taking place. That this was Ferrix is kind of a backwater that people didn't need to pay that much attention to, and now they're officially occupying it. I agree that that's kind of where things are standing right.
And
now,
my guess also is if we had this scene, we've probably not seen the last of Ferrix.
Agreed.
Why show them setting up shop here if we're never gonna return?
I know it would make no sense, but we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. It's not like a TV show has never done a weird random thing before, as I learn all the time right now on Decoding TV. So, okay. Only other thing is we get a brief scene with at Coruscant Imperial Security with Dedra and her underling. Like, she sees Blevin in the hall with his underlings, and she's like, oh, I'm still really angry about what happened last week's episode. And so they're talking about trying to figure out this pattern and if there's a rebellion forming. And she says, she names a bunch of events that have occurred, right? She
talks about these are like, all things on planets that are already canonical to Star Wars.
Right. Hosnian Prime, Kessel, Jakku, and Fondor, right? So where are these places from, Patrick Willems?
Okay, Hosnian Prime is a planet that I've always had a beef with. Hosnian Prime is kind of like representative of a beef I've always had with The Force Awakens. Hosnian Prime, after the events of Return of the Jedi, after the Battle of Endor, become the Hosnian system, specifically Hosnian Prime, which is like the prime planet in that system, becomes the new capital of the new Galactic Republic. And there's the part in The Force Awakens when Starkiller Base, to show off its power, destroys the Hosnian system. It blows up a string of planets, and they're all like, oh no, that's where the Republic is. The movie never shows us the Republic or anyone on Hosnian Prime, but it's a big deal that it gets destroyed. So that's that.
Well, I think we see like one shot of people on the planet, right?
Yeah, we see some extras whose names we do not know, who never speak, look up in fear.
It's because if they speak, you have to pay them,
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's that. That's Hosnian Prime. Kessel, you know, in Solo, A Star Wars Story, we see how the Millennium Falcon makes the Kessel run in 12 parsecs. That's the big heist where they're stealing. Oh, my God. You know, you've got to keep it cold.
I like how you literally didn't need to introduce this part of the explanation, and you just went right into it, Patrick.
I know it's it's killing me. What is the thing that they are stealing? Oh my God, it's
coaxium.
Yes, coaxium. That's what they are stealing from Kessel, where there's like a mining colony, and the thing about coaxium, as anyone who's ever ridden the Millennium Falcon ride at Galaxy's Edge knows, you gotta keep it cold.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very important. Anyway, I'm sorry to go off on that tangent. Oh, and Jakku is where Rey is from.
Yes.
In the sequel trilogy. Oh, and
Fondor. Go ahead.
Fondor is does not really show up in the movies, to my knowledge, but apparently it's in the game Battlefront 2.
Mm-hmm.
And was a big thing in like the Clone Wars.
Yeah, gotcha. So events are happening at all these places. And Dedra is trying to figure out if there's some kind of pattern. And she's like, if I was them, I wouldn't have a pattern. And I think what's interesting about this a little bit is that as far as we know, the Imperial Starpath unit was not part of some concerted effort, right? Like, that was just something Andor did on his own, rogue. He was not operating as part of a network of spies or anything like that.
No.
So she is literally seeing patterns where none exist, at least when it comes to the Starpath unit. But yeah,
it's true. And also we see Dedra, popping some pills.
Mm. So and, perhaps that will come into play later.
Yeah.
But she's like, it's too random to be random, which is just like, or it could just be random, you know, possible.
But again, she is also someone who wants to get ahead and was shot down in the previous episode while Blevin
is invested. She's invested in like making there be something, right? Yeah.
This is basically like her one thing. She's like, I can't let this go. I need to prove that this is something. To prove them, also to prove Blevin wrong and to like get a leg up on him. I mean, this show is all just like, you know, just ambitious people in a bureaucracy.
Yeah. Totally. Love it. Okay.
Yeah.
Those are all the non-Aldani storylines for this episode. Yes,
except
Patrick?
For the final scene.
Oh yeah. So I was going to get to that at the end because it'll tie into that. So
exactly, it's heavily related to Aldani.
Yeah, indeed. Before we move on, Patrick, if people are enjoying this dialogue, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
David, you can find more of my work at youtube.com/PatrickHWillems, where I make increasingly long video essays talking all about movies. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Patrick H. Willems.
All right. And we're really grateful for Patrick joining us for each weekly recap of Andor. And I always want to shout out, of course, on Decoding TV, we're covering She-Hulk and Rings of Power, obviously. We're also finishing up our run of House of the Dragon over on a Cast of Kings podcast. And if you want to get ad-free episodes of all those podcasts, become a paid member at decodingtv.com. Thanks to everyone who's doing that and helping support us. We would not be able to do this podcast without all the paid members at decodingtv.com. So we really appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
All right, Patrick, let's dive into the rest of the episode, the Aldani stuff. So there's a lot of scenes in Aldani. I don't know that we need to cover every single one of these scenes, but maybe
Dave,
we will.
We got to cover everything. We got to cover them waking up, drinking weird milk,
yes,
walking
Dray
to one
milk.
Place,
Dray
walking
milk,
to another place,
mm-hmm.
Walking in formation. We got to cover everything. We don't.
Again, one of the things I really appreciate about this episode is you really, other than maybe Cinta and Tamarin, you really get to spend like a lot of time with Steen, a little bit of time with Nemec this episode, and you get different flavors of what the rebellion is like. Steen is obviously in it because
I thought it was Skeen with a K.
Nope. Wait. Hold on. Now, I am not sure. Maybe you're right. I don't know why I've been messing up these character names so badly.
Well, David, you do a lot of podcasting and have to keep the name straight of a million characters on a ton of shows.
Except for this one, apparently.
I'm just saying, a bunch of the shows that I watch that I'm actually behind on, because I have
you're
not
right,
enough.
You're right. It's Skeen. Jesus, I can't believe I got that wrong. Okay,
sorry. Again, you have a lot of characters to remember. I mean, I believe on this WTF interview, I believe Tony Gilroy says, "Yeah, we have 197 speaking roles in this
season."
Wow. So. Whew, that's a lot for us to keep track of.
And that's the thing. They're introducing so many new characters, but they also give a lot of like nameless characters or background characters speaking lines. Like there's a Corporal Kinsey or something this episode that like you meet this guy. There's a named role named Kimsey. We're probably never going to see that character again is my guess, or maybe at most one other episode, right? So.
And also, last episode, we were talking about how we did not know the name of Anton Lesser's character.
Yes.
He is now – he does have a name on IMDb. Yes. He is Major Partagas.
Yes.
And I don't think anyone ever says that. But
not 100% sure. It might have been in the captions. But in any case, okay, you're right. It's Skeen, S-K-E-E-N. Apologies.
I forgive you.
Thank you. And so – Skeen is kind of in it for revenge, you know, because we learn later that it's because his brother has basically offed himself because of actions of the Empire. But we also see what's his name?
Nemec,
who is like a true believer, zealot. He wants to write a manifesto, and he has this cool Polaroid camera looking thing. Basically, he's a hipster. Is kind of my take on it.
He is. He also sometimes, and I think this might mostly be to him being short, and the hat he was wearing gave me Mouse from The Matrix vibes.
Yeah.
But he is just like all like he's literally talking about how his like he's like writing a like written manifesto that's not ready yet. But he's also young and probably hasn't like gone through the personal like tragedies because of the empire that other people have. So he's just like really idealistic. And also seems like he probably studied politics, maybe in college.
Yeah.
He's got like a poli-sci degree.
Totally. Yeah. But he shows this basically like it's like someone showing a compass to someone who has an iPhone. It's like, hey, look, we don't even need Apple's technology to tell where we are. We can just use this compass that's made out of like a needle and a leaf and a bowl of water, basically. That's all you need to tell the direction, you know? I thought that was nice. And you also get a sense of like who Nemec is. Like Nemec is a true believer, right? He believes in it to his core. He's basically the opposite of Andor, you know, Andor, mm-hmm. who's basically doing just this just for money, right?
As he does tell them in this episode.
Mm-hmm, he does.
Also, one thing that they seem to indicate is that, and of course I'm checking my list of everyone's names, it seems that I don't know how serious this is, but it seems that Cinta has shacked up with Vel. As Skeen says, sharing a blanket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, like, she's taken, don't, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree if you try to get with Cinta. So
exactly.
But Cinta is described as stone cold and fearless, the toughest one here. So we don't really get to spend that much time with Cinta. And I don't know if we will in this show, unfortunately. But we do get a lot of nice character development with Skeen and with Nemec this episode, and that's nice. So.
Yeah, I mean, one of the arcs of the episode is Skeen and Andor's like kind of difficult relationship where, because like at the beginning, Andor wakes up and sees that like, oh, his weapons and stuff are gone, and then sees that, you know, Skeen is like, Vel had asked him to like check them all, just like look at his stuff. He's there shirtless. He's got some tattoos. They have a talk about the tattoos. Then, and it's an ongoing thing of like Skeen not trusting Andor. I probably shouldn't breeze through this entire thing because we have important scenes.
You can breeze through. It's cool.
But we have Skeen notices that Andor has the Kyber crystal on the rope around his neck, the one that Luthen gave him as like an investment. And then at one point puts a knife to his throat and like pulls it off of him. And is like, why does this guy have this like really valuable treasure? Like this doesn't seem right. No one would bring this on this.
It would
mission.
Be a weird thing. Cause they've been living in huts, you know, eating dirt, you know, for the last 5 months. And so why would this guy, it would be like a really you would think something is very suspicious about that person, right?
If exactly they
had basically the equivalent of tens of thousands of dollars that they're carrying with them, right?
And one thing I really liked here is that Andor, after he kind of like takes a moment to like make his decision, but he just is like, screw it, I'm just gonna tell them what the deal is, because this like he's aware that he seems kind of sketchy, and it's like, let it's probably better to just like be honest with them than to have them like kind of like distrusting me for a while. So he's like, look, I'm getting paid to be here. That's why I showed up. That's why I have this thing. Sorry, I'm not like a diehard believer like the rest of you. I am in this for the money. That's why Vel didn't tell you, because I was dropped on her like a day ago. That's the situation. And, you know,
is the only thing about the episode that didn't ring quite true to me was he gives a speech about, hey, like, if you're looking for excuses to not do it, like, that's cool. But like, I'm solid. That's kind of what he's trying to say.
Right.
That didn't really ring true to me. I didn't feel like Skeen is looking for excuses to not do the heist. You know, he's like, everyone's nervous. It's okay to be nervous, but like, don't put it on me. Like, but they're just rightfully suspicious of him, in my opinion. There's no, it didn't come off to me as Skeen is trying to come up with excuses to not do it. You know what I mean? Like, that was the only part that was a little bit weird to me, you know?
I honestly forgot. I think I might have missed that line.
And he's like, everyone's nervous. It's always nervous the most before, like, the day before the heist, basically. And so, right.
Right. Skeen seems pretty all in on this. I wasn't doubting.
Exactly. So that was a little weird. Here's what is cool. What was a nice touch about the episode is throughout the episode, you kind of, you know, Andor is not someone we've really learned that much about this season so far, but we start learning that he is actually like really competent, right? So earlier on, there's a scene where Vel's like, "Hey, do you know how to fly this ship?" And he's like, "Wait, you don't know how to fly it?" And he seems to know like the schematic of how the ship is laid out and everything like that, stuff that's not in the manual. And so that's a pretty cool moment. Then later on, he's able to identify which hand people are using as their dominant ones and how to like march in a way that's convincing. I really like
that scene. Yeah.
Yeah. You want Andor to feel like, you want it to feel like Andor is like contributing a lot to this group, because we don't know that much about Andor yet. But one of the things that we do know, is that he becomes a captain later, you know, part of the Rebel Alliance. And so like, and clearly he has some skill here and is a valuable member of the, like, there's a reason you want there to be a reason why they would want to keep him and not just be suspicious of him.
Right.
And I think this episode gives you that. So,
And what seems like really a recurring thing is that he's, especially with the part where he makes the suggestion, they're like rehearsing, they're walking in formation. Clearly they will be disguised as Imperial officers. And he points out that, you know, because if they end up needing to like be in a shootout, they should like adjust their formation based on having like the blasters on like their outside hand. And like one guy, it's like, oh, he should swap sides because he's left-handed. And they ask everyone, they're like, wait, have you like clocked which hand is everyone's preferred hand? And like that, and then the scene in episode 3 with Luthen where he's talking about how he's able to get into these like, you know, these Imperial ships and like sneak in, and they're overconfident. Like the Cassian's big skill seems to just be able to like read people really, really quickly. Yeah. And like study them, like understand like how to approach them, you know, how to just like their like physical characteristics. It's not quite like a crazy Sherlock Holmes thing being like, oh, I see a piece of lint on your shirt collar. That must mean like
SpaghettiOs 5 days ago in Spain, you know, like,
right, because you were like sad that, because you recently broke up with your girlfriend. It's not that kind of stuff, but like you can see how he definitely, like, you know, he has a very particular set of skills, and how he's, it's nice that he is genuinely useful on this job. He is actually contributing something, and really is, especially after the part where he's like, wait, you guys don't know how to fly this ship properly, is really making me think, man, if he wasn't there, this might be a disaster.
Yeah, totally. We get a couple scenes with Lieutenant Gorn at the garrison, and I think they're pretty cool. There's one scene where the function of the scenes at the garrison is basically you're seeing how Lieutenant Gorn is creating his cover. Right. Mm-hmm. From my understanding, the most important one is these two underlings that say to him, we did our best to get everything ready. And he's like, hey, well, you got to paint that wall. And he's like, and they explain to him, hey, FYI, permission to speak freely. No one wants to work here. And one of the only reasons we work here is to see the eye, which is this kind of intense meteor shower esque weather event that's going to happen in next episode
during the heist.
It's going to serve as a distraction, right? And if we have anything, if you deprive people of seeing the eye, people are going to get really pissed and it'll be bad for you. And so Lieutenant Gorn is like, okay, fine, everyone can see the eye. And the idea is that there was no suspicion on him that way, that he like allocated people away from, you know, the Imperial payroll, right?
I mean, all the stuff with Lieutenant Gorn scenes at the garrison, like the recurring thing is that people there, despite this being the Empire, they don't take that job very seriously and are mostly just kind of screwing around. Like, you have the first two guys and Gorn is like reprimanding them for having set up like just pieces of metal for target practice. So they're just like goofing off, shooting their blasters when they should be working. There's these guys who are just like, hey,
there's Corporal Kimsey who's like just chilling on the roof, and he's like, I see you're enjoying the view, but you get the sense he's not supposed to be there enjoying the view. He's supposed to be doing something else, right? Yeah.
I will say that second scene, with enjoying the view, we mentioned this in the previous episode, but I love the way that with just very little work and very little screen time and also minimal visual effects, the stuff on Aldani has really made TIE fighters more ominous than they've ever been before. Watching them come up over the hill, we talked about it in the last episode, but it happens again in this, but you see it from a distance. And then we get this great shot following a TIE fighter flying along over this lake toward the garrison. And then I love this shot. It's like a tracking shot behind Gorn walking along the top of the garrison, as then just in front of him, the TIE fighter just flies by, as in for him that's just a normal thing.
Obviously
Ben Burtt's original sound design for the TIE fighter, which I believe is made from partially baby elephants screaming, is one of the greatest, most iconic sounds in all of cinema. And putting it in this kind of environment where it's so quiet and still, and it's just mountains around, and then you get this kind of horrifying, roaring screech of that thing. It's again, it's a thing we've seen a million times, and suddenly it feels so much more powerful than it ever has.
Yeah, and I think it's because, and I'm sure Star Wars has done this before, so I'm not saying this is the first time, but you're seeing it from the perspective of someone on the ground. When you're seeing it in space, a lot of TIE fighters are cannon fodder in Star Wars movies, right? But you're seeing it as you're a group of seven people on the ground. You see this massive ship fly overhead. It can easily clock you. It can take you out if it wants to. It's scary the way they show TIE fighters in the show. And so I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. And a thing that another scene it connects to is when Cassian and the whole heist crew they're basically around a fire at night. And I think, and someone there says to the rebellion. Yeah. And
I think it's Bell that says it. Yeah.
Yeah. Seeing this group of five people, is it five?
It's seven, I believe.
Okay. Seven of them. But a small group of people and it being oh, right, this is the rebellion. We're used to from other Star Wars seeing, the Rebellion is an army. They have ranks. They have they have a fleet of fighter jets or fighter spaceships or whatever. It's and seeing it here where it's the Rebellion is a bunch of people around a campfire, and that's basically it. And it really changes our perspective on this whole thing. And so it's this is. They are up against something so much larger than them, and they are so outnumbered that this really is a very difficult. This is a different situation than we're used to seeing in Star Wars.
Yeah, and the episode does a lot to hammer that home. It tells you all these different stories of why these people want to be part of the rebellion. It actually makes Star Wars better, in my opinion. Right, that's what I'm saying. I've always thought of the rebellion like you thought of it. This army, massive monolith. Oh, of course everyone hates the Empire. Why would you want to go after it? But it's everyone has their own rebellion. Everyone has their own reason they're going up against the Empire. And we really get a big sense of it here. We have people like Steen, whose brother died. We have people like Andor, who's being paid. We have people like Nemec, who just believes in the cause fully to his core. And all these other things. I love that whole diversity of views about the rebellion. There's also, of course, the title of the episode, which is based off of a proverb that is real on Earth. The axe forgets, but the tree remembers, right? That basically the people doing the oppression, the people doing the damage, often don't even think about it. Whereas the people who the damage is being done to, the tree, they never forget. And that is who becomes the rebellion, right? So I love all that detail and nuance that the show is giving us about the rebellion. Agreed completely. So one point about Gorn. So the seven people includes Gorn, FYI.
Okay.
Maybe he was only like five or six in that scene. But there's that dialogue he has with Kimsey on the roof. And one of the guys says, yeah, like, can you imagine if there are thousands of those Aldani people here? You could smell them from here, huh? And he's like, yeah, I guess you could. Then later we learn that Gorn fell in love with an Aldani woman and lost her. And that's kind of why he turned against the Empire. And so that explains his... And I love in this show, in my opinion, this show kind of gives you enough to like put the pieces together of what's happening. It doesn't explain, by the way, that woman was Gorn. Like that's why Gorn was pissed. That, you know, like I love that it gives you just enough to kind of put the pieces together yourself. And it's very satisfying storytelling wise. So anyway.
I completely agree. I feel dumb for not mentioning Gorn's backstory earlier. And it also makes me curious because I think they were saying that like in the past for the Eye, there would be like, they refer to the Aldani people as just Donnie.
Yeah.
And I think they were saying like there would used to be like thousands of them here, but yeah. there'll be like, what, like a few hundred?
Hundreds now. Yeah. I think.
And so I'm also very curious to see what hundreds of Aldani people look like, assuming that we'll see them out there. I've got to say, there is like so much that I'm excited about in the next episode. So much that's been built up. And can I talk about the last scene?
Yeah. Let's talk about it. So there's a couple things happen in the final scenes, right, of this episode. One is there's a big question this whole time about what is going on with Vel during the heist. And as of the end of this episode, that question remains unresolved. So we don't know. But she does give Tamarin control of the crew. She's like, Tamarin's in charge now, and don't worry about me. You'll see me later. So
and
really curious.
Cinta goes with her?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so it's so just really the curious. Men remaining.
Yeah. Maybe Vel is the wild card here. Who knows? But anyway, Tamarin takes over the crew, and so that's a notable change. And then the final scene, you're talking about with Luthen, right?
With Luthen, yeah.
Yeah. So we see Luthen back on Coruscant, and he's kind of listening to the radio, trying to pick up signals of what's going on with the heist, I think, right? And trying to understand. Yeah.
It seems like he's hoping for an update. And again, it's the kind of thing that we're not used to seeing in Star Wars because normally it's like, oh, right, it's the rebellion. They're a whole army. They can like radio each other, whatever, pop up with like a hologram. And
they're like on MCU, The Avengers, where they just touch their ear and they can just talk to everyone else, right?
Well, like, I mean, that's like every spy movie ever.
Yeah.
That's not how it always works.
Yes.
And here it's like, he set them up and funded their little operation. And now he's just in a back room at his store hoping for like a radio update. But all he can do is sit there and hope for the best. It's like he is totally separated from it and so removed from it. And again, a thing that we're not used to seeing. Normally this is a big, like super coordinated operation. And then his employee, whose name I will have in a second, Clea Markey, Luthen's employee that we saw in the previous episode, who I think in the last episode, it wasn't clear if she knew about him working with the rebellion. That she might just work.
I think it was at least somewhat clear that she was like covering for him.
Okay.
For something, because she knew to like distract the driver guy.
Right. Right.
So, but you're right. Like she now, it's very clear that she knows everything he's up to.
Oh, and she is also like a part of this as well.
Yeah.
And because you know, she's like, you know, she tells him she doesn't like seeing him nervous, and it's also just kind of like they're both very tense. There because they are on a different planet and they are just, you know, waiting for some kind of update. Also, I know this is not a show about pointing out Easter eggs on Andor because there are a million places on the internet that will cover that for you. But I do want to mention, on the shelf behind Luthen, we do see some holocrons. mm-hmm. which are these things that store like holographic messages in Star Wars lore. Also, a few Shankara stones from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Just a little Lucasfilm Easter egg. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you look up kind of like on
you
the right.
You think Indiana Jones takes place in the same universe as Star Wars? I guess Star Wars takes place in our universe, right? So,
yeah, just a long time ago. And and the Shankara stones continued. And then in the 1930s, this one village in India found them. And they were, you know, holy to them. But yeah, just there's your little Easter egg update. Shankara stones, they're there.
I like this idea of Luthen saying, I wanted it too much. Like, we get the feeling that Luthen, by bringing Andor aboard, has put himself out there, right? Like, mm-hmm. he's put himself in danger because Vel was the only one that could connect back to him, right? None of the other people in the heist crew knew that Luthen even existed. But now, and with Andor, he's helped to make the crew better, and we see that this episode, but it's also put Luthen at risk, and that's kind of what he remarks upon. There's a lot of great lines in this episode. I just want to point out, there's like a lot of great dialogue in the episode. I mean, I apologize, I'm paraphrasing here, but Luthen basically says something along the lines of like, you know, she says, it'll all be over tomorrow at this time or something. And Luthen says, or it will just be beginning, you know, something along those lines. Like it's either going to be over or it's going to be beginning. Skeen at one point says that his brother was killed because an imperial prefect took his land and flooded it. And then his brother committed suicide. And he says, quote, I always hated the empire. I don't know what to call what I feel now. End quote. I like that. It's like, I hated them before. Now it's like, a fulminating rage that is persistent and you know, like whatever. You could put words to it. Love that.
Yeah.
You know, it's too random to be random. Like this kind of, there's just a bunch of like great bon mots, a lot of great, like, oh wow, that's a great one, a memorable one-liner.
I know. Hey, these Gilroys, good at writing.
They know how to write a script, you know?
Because, five episodes in, we have yet to have an episode not written by a Gilroy brother.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And even, I don't know if we've mentioned this before, but I don't think for this episode, but John Gilroy, a third Gilroy brother, is also one of the main editors on the show.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything the Gilroys can't do, Patrick Willems? Anyway.
I don't know.
Any other thoughts on this episode? I'm psyched for the next episode. It's going to be a really long wait.
I know. The next 7 days. Yeah, it's going to be tough. I hope this season gives us a Mon Mothma dinner party. I want to see more of the Coruscant elites. Mm-hmm, I want to see them in their finest wares. Yes. Sipping
space
champagne.
I will say the Mon Mothma and Perrin's outfits were like really awesome this whole episode. Like,
oh yeah.
They looked super cool. So
yeah. Also, Coruscant at night just looks awesome. The you really see how shiny and expensive looking her car is when it's like cruising through the city.
There are seven people in the heist crew. Okay, there's Vel, Skeen, Nemec, Tamarin, Cinta, Gorn, and Andor. Okay, we know Andor survives. Of the other six, how many people do you think are going to die next episode? I think we're going to get... My guess is we're going to get at least 1 to 2 deaths, is my guess.
Yeah.
Because I don't think everything's going to go smoothly with a heist. I'm just putting that out there. Like, I think something will go wrong with a heist. That's how all heist movies and shows go. But it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, Tony Gilroy has talked a lot about subverting audience expectations, right? And at this point, the heist formula is so crystallized. Like, we know, hey, they've spent 2 episodes planning the heist. Now they do the heist. Something will go wrong. They'll figure out a way to accommodate. They will triumph in the end, possibly with some costs. That is the formula for a heist show or a heist movie. I think Tony Gilroy knows that that is the formula and may try to subvert it somehow, because that's what he has always talked about, how he tries to like subvert what the formula is and what audience expectation is. So it wouldn't surprise me if something really wild went off next episode. But assuming it does follow the formula, I think we're going to lose 1 or 2 people. Any guesses, predictions on how many people will die next episode?
How many people? I feel like saying like 3 is an easy number. yeah. I will say,
if anyone dies,
Nemec, right?
I'm not feeling good about Nemec. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mostly because the young idealist, right?
Yeah.
Right. Which one is going to hurt the most?
Which one is going to motivate Andor the most to become who we know in Rogue One? Right.
So. Yeah. And I don't want to make too many predictions because then me going into watching it will just be like, well, I just want to make sure that I'm proven correct. Mm-hmm. But
good impression of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. That's how I think I come off. Who knows? Yeah, maybe it'll be a situation where the heist goes perfectly and I don't know. And then Vel betrays them and tries to steal all the money for herself. And turns out she's actually working with the Empire.
That would be a thing. That could be a thing that happens. Who knows?
Maybe Darth Vader will show up and swipe it all and bring it back to Mustafar so he can sleep on a big pile of money. I don't think that will happen, to be clear.
All right. Well, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of the Decoding TV podcast covering Andor. Find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com and find us on Twitter, TikTok, YouTube, at Decoding TV. Every episode is available on YouTube as well. We hope people will check us out there, and I get a lot of awesome comments from there as well. And of course, you can always email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. He is Patrick Willems. I'm David Chen. We'll see you next week for another recap of Andor.
Goodbye, and #release the dinner party cut.